Hey, some cool new theme music from our new sponsor. More on that in a minute, though. First, hello and welcome to the Art of the Cup podcast, brought to you in partnership with Boris Effects and our sponsors Jump Desktop and now Lens Distortions. I'm Steve Hallfish. I'm a working film and TV editor. For the last 9 years, I've done more than 400 interviews with the world's best editors. I've been using Boris Effects products for more than 30 years, and I'm proud to partner with them to bring you some great filmmaking content. Today, we're talking with Kelly Matsumoto, ACE, and Dylan Highsmith about editing Fast 10, or Fast X if you prefer. Dylan has worked his way up mainly as a VFX editor, including on Fast 5, and has been an editor on Fast and Furious 6, Furious 7, The Fate of the Furious, and Fast 9. He also edited Pacific Rim Uprising and Star Trek Beyond. Kelly's experience with the Fast series goes back to before 2006 with the Fast and the Furious Tokyo Drift. Also, Fast 5, Fast and Furious 6, and Fast 9. Kelly's other credits include The Meg, Star Trek Beyond, The Mummy Returns, The Mummy Tomb of the Dragon Emperor, and Van Helsing, among others. Before I hop into our discussion with Kelly and Dylan, a brief thank you to our sponsors. Jump Desktop is a high-performance and secure app that lets you virtually connect to your editing bays as if you were physically there. Keep all your assets in one place and connect to your powerful editing bays from anywhere. Jump Desktop's high-performance remote desktop protocol lets you edit from any low-powered laptop. With end-to-end encryption, native support for macOS and Windows, and multi-monitor support, you can be productive from anywhere. Jump Desktop also has collaborative screen sharing for collaboration with your team. See what thousands of editors have been using to get their work done from across the world. Visit jumpdesktop.com/cut to begin your free no-limits 14-day trial today. And to our partner, Boris Effects. I've been using Boris Effects and Sapphire for more than 20 years, so they're not just a sponsor to me. I feel like they've been a partner in my cutting room for decades, helping me deliver on the creative vision of my clients, directors, and producers. For all of us, our work is about bringing a creative idea to the screen, and for me, Boris Effects is one of the important tools that I use to do that. To see how they can help you on your latest project, head on over to borisfx.com and check out the Boris Effects suite, which includes Sapphire, Continuum, Mocha Pro, Silhouette, and Optics, all in a low-cost monthly or annual subscription. If you want to read this interview with great visual support, you can go to borisfx.com/AOTC. That site also has other great filmmaking content, so keep that bookmarked. We're almost ready for this week's interview, but first, let me tell you about our latest sponsor, Lens Distortions. Lens Distortions offers premium music and effects that are perfect for film and TV, like the track you're hearing now, as well as our theme music at the top of the episode. Their web platform offers really helpful options for editors, such as variations of every track and sound effects pairings that complement the music. Me personally, I've been using Lens Distortions assets for years and can say that they are top-notch quality. They have a special offer just for Art of the Cut listeners. Visit lensdistortions.com/AOTC to claim your discount. That's lensdistortions, plural, with an S, .com/AOTC. Check them out now. And now, Kelly Matsumoto, ACE, and Dylan Highsmith on editing Fast 10. Kelly and Dylan, it's so good to have you on Art of the Cut. You guys have been on here before, and I can't wait for our discussion. I wanted to bring up the fact that we're missing a couple of people, and I was wondering if you could fill me in on who we don't have on the call right now. Kelly?
So we had Lori Yanovich and Corbin Mell, and we've worked with them a lot in the past. And Corbin was our visual effects editor on Fast 9, and Laura was our first, and she's been a first with us since Fast 6, I think. So we moved them up on this show to be editors, and they did made some great contributions on this one.
Fantastic. I'm glad we chatted about them. We're going to stick with the two people that we do have. What Fast movie is this for you, Kelly?
I was on 3, 5, 6, 9, and 10. So this is my fifth one.
And what about you, Dylan?
This is my sixth one.
That's crazy. I want to start with the opening pre-title sequence. It seemed a good way for the fans to get back into this franchise that they love so much. Can somebody talk about that? What happens before the titles happen?
Yeah, so that was pretty early on, kind of one of the very first things that we centered the movie around, just back into like early pre-production. That was going to be the in for the audience into the movie, to introduce the new antagonist, Dante, through the lens of Fast Five. So we have an awesome archival team at Universal, led by Bill Paxton, not the actor. We knew we were going to be revisiting Fast Five very early in the process on this. So one of the first things we did was just have Universal Archives pull up all of the dailies, everything, to recreate that sequence from a different perspective. And it went through a lot of different iterations, but it was always going to be the Rashomon idea of, let's see what is the most iconic scene in the franchise through the eyes of the bad guys, through the other side. When we shot it on film, to the rest of the film is shot digitally, but we shot that so that the new pieces would match into the old. And yeah, we really designed that around, how do we reconstruct this scene so that everybody who's fans of the series has seen a thousand times before to see it fresh. So we actually took a lot of daily shots, and then with Peter Chang, who's our visual effects supervisor, we put them through motion tracking so that we could put Jason Momoa into existing shots that were shot on the bridge in Fast Five with motion control into the old footage, and just really seamlessly integrate that. So that was a big endeavor, and probably one of the earliest endeavors we started on this project.
One of the other things that I love talking about, this is obviously an action movie, we're going to talk a lot about action, but there's great dialogue in it. And I wanted to talk about the choice of shot sizes and when to be in a dialogue scene, when to be on a reaction, when to be on the person speaking. I was thinking about, in specifically, early on, there's a scene in Dom's garage where they're talking about like a carburetor or something, you know, rebuilding a car. And there's some important like thematic elements in that dialogue that happen. You might not remember that exactly, but there's a nice two shot. When you're thinking about a dialogue scene, how do you decide on playing things on a two, on a close, on a reaction? Kelly?
I think you take it case by case. Laura cut that scene and she did a perfect job on it. I think for me, in a dialogue scene, you're looking for the drama of the moment and how somebody's reaction, the dialogue, what they're saying. Do you need a reaction? I find it nice to try to play things out if you can with a two shot. And so it feels bigger, and especially on a big screen, and to see both people interacting with each other. But sometimes it's good to go in for the close up to hit the moment and make it dramatic and, you know, catch the subtle reaction. It's not really a formula. Mm-hmm. Maybe you'll start with a wide just to acclimate yourself to the geography. But then as you get into it, then there's a flow and a pace.
I actually think it's hugely important in a film like this, and especially in something that's like an ensemble, where so much of this movie and all of these movies are about the relationships between these characters. And so when you can show like how they share a frame versus when you can show how they're reacting to what the other person's saying is such an integral part of how you connect these characters together. When Han and Dom are sharing a frame, like you get to show they're equal and sharing this moment, or they're toasting, versus when they're listening, it's more about the character who's on screen.
And there's great action sequences, but then there's a lovely scene with Abuelita, Rita Moreno's character, and everybody having a dinner, a meal together outside. But those dialogue scenes are also paced up. They felt like they were active and fun, and the energy maintained even through dialogue. Can you talk about, like, maybe your choice of if that scene had been in a different movie, that the pace would have been different?
There's a lot going on at the beginning. There's a lot of characters in this movie. There's a lot of characters to catch up to. So one of the most important things are those barbecue scenes. And it was a choice early on to make it so normally those scenes happen in the end of the film, that this starts the movie. And structurally, it's this movie to some extent is a reverse Fast and Furious movie. It starts with the barbecue and then ends with the team all separate. That scene is all about just getting to see them almost for one of the last times in the film all together. And just how soon can you get across to the audience just the feeling of camaraderie and family and their relations without slowing the movie down so much where you're getting to the first act action sequence like really late? Because there are a lot of character scenes we hit before we get to Rome, which is the big kind of first action set piece that starts off the film. So that was always kind of conscious of how do we not shortchange these scenes and how do we get to the essence of them without letting them slow down the movie. In another movie, that might be a much longer kind of dialogue scene.
A tricky thing on this movie, because there were a couple of extra scenes and it was really trying to figure out the pacing to get to Rome. And like Dylan said, not shortchanging it, because you want everybody to be happy and satisfy everybody, the fans, and I do too, that really the barbecue scenes, because the family's all together, it's really fun, but you're setting up a lot. And so you have to pull back, even maybe pace it quicker, like you said, and cut out some moments and cut out some jokes and everything just to get it so that people aren't saying, when are we going to get to the action scene?
And as you pointed out, it's a reverse of the way these Fast movies are laid out usually. So if this scene had played at the end of the movie, it might have even been paced differently than if the same scene played at the beginning of the movie.
Oh, absolutely.
Where a scene sits in a movie depends a lot on how it's paced. So they head off to Rome, and you've got a bunch of different characters that you're trying to juggle, a bunch of different storylines in this Rome chase sequence. Did that end up being intercut the way it was scripted?
All major action set pieces, you script it one way, you pre-visit one way, and you end up somewhere completely different. Like the broad strokes of that scene didn't change from how it was scripted, but especially the intercutting of how long you're away from each character, you have to keep tracking how long you're missing Dante, Jason Momoa, or how long you're away from Dom and Letty. The other kind of tricky thing with this, which is something we always have to play with in all these movies, is the how much you're going to push believability and reality. And there's an added thing of, how long is the bomb rolling? How long have you been in with other characters that have less urgency or are just talking? Or how long are you with Roman and Tej in the sewers that the audiences start going to think when you come back to the bomb, oh crap, the bomb was rolling that long? So it really felt like a juggling act the whole way through with a literal ball.
Let's talk about this. Stunts are usually done for just a short moment of time in a sequence. So let's talk about getting in and out of some of those stunts that could only have a useful life of only a few frames or a second or two. Can you talk about that idea of, oh, before this, you see something that you can't show?
Yeah, the stunt team on these are incredible. So second unit was split between Spiro Razzatos, who shot the Rome sequence, and Alexander Witt, who shot the third act sequence. They engineered like an actual rolling ball that was on some sort of wire gyroscope thing that could smash through things. So it's incredible what they can do, but yes, it also does limit how many frames you can be on this before, okay, at that point, the cars aren't up to speed. Can we get an extra frame just so we can settle on that shot for more? Do you believe that, or do you feel the car is slowing down? And visual effects can help with that to some extent. A lot of it is also just double, triple, quadrupling up the action so that you get a sense of each beat being bigger than it is. Can you get away with a triple cut on that impact? Can you get away with a quadruple cut? Is that making the sequence too messy or disorienting? Is it actually helping the like visceral energy of the impact?
Are those double, triple, and quadruple cuts usually coming from different angles, or are you even trying from the same angle from a different take?
Usually a different camera angle on the stunt. Yeah, because usually what happens is they do the stunt and the car is destroyed. So then after that, you're either dealing with another type of car that you'll have to maybe cover or change a little bit with visual effects. But they'll do it the stunt practically with a real car. So then you're trying to get different camera angles, and there's a lot of different cameras on the one stunt.
The listening audience won't be able to see this, but I wanted to play a clip for you that I have and just discuss, maybe it would refresh your memory about how the tricks or the difficulties in cutting a scene like this. I want to share my screen and then show you this help. Here we go. This scene with Letty through the streets of Rome. And then maybe you can talk me through this.
This is actually a great scene to discuss, especially in stunts and the question that you brought up, because this specific gag of how this SUV explodes in the air and then starts rolling and then rolls to the edge and the bomb stops. Like, there's no way to do that special effects all in one. So there's one kind of setup where they just started the fire under the car, which is just to get him jumping out and the initial explosion. There's another setup that is just all about the launch of just getting that car, the explosion big at the beginning, and getting that car as high in the air as possible and as much throw as possible. And then there's a separate kind of rig that they set up, which is just the kind of rolling of it, where it's just,
there's an amazing shot where it's rolling and Letty's, the stunt person, is alongside of it. Like, that right there is crazy.
So that's from the initial one, which was just all about getting air and getting big and just getting that impact. And they ran, it's a shame because we can only use either Letty or Momoa on that by, but like both of them, it's too long to wait on the shot, but both of them go by as that car is exploding in the background. And that this stunt was actually tricky because you have to merge all of these kind of different like stunt interactions so it feels as one seamless gag, because there's one that's it's only exploding. There's one that's just rolling. There's one that's just coming to the edge. Like, this shot that you're actually parked on is the stitch between the stunt where it's flying up in the air and where it's rolling. So this was important for sound and the mix stage to when you're on Dom, that's where you need to sell the impact that it's hit. And after that, it goes into a roll and stops.
And then there's great angles, too. I'm showing us a shot from very high up looking down beautiful Roman street. So you've also got the variety of shots that they're giving you, too.
Drone footage has like really changed things in the last film or two. You'd get these incredible shots. We have helicopters, too, that are with Fred North, and he's an amazing helicopter pilot who gets awesome shots, but then these drone shots too have added to it.
Yeah. I'm just going to play the last couple of seconds here.
This is one of my favorite gags.
Cool. That's a bunch of edits right there. Like, you might think that's two edits or something, but what was that? Like five. Cutting his preps to jump over that obstacle.
Yeah, I think this is my favorite stunt in the whole movie. It's so simple, but the motorcycle driver who pulled this off, there's only two guys in the world who can do this type of gag, and like, they did this practically. So everything has to be built up around this. We create the frenetic energy going into that. There's obviously her, you have to clock Dante seeing that he can do that, he can create this obstacle, then him kicking it, it falling, her tracking that happening, and then slamming on the brakes, getting ready that she's just going to go over it. She's not going to let this stop her. There's a lot of shots, but each one of these shots has a meaning. And especially when, like, when you're going through these sequences time and time again, trying to get them down for time or get them down for visual effects, kind of budgetary concerns or things, you're looking at every shot going, does this need to be there? Like every shot in the sequence, even though there's a lot of cuts, has an importance and has a meaning in telling the story just to build up what Letty as a character is willing to keep doing to just stay on Momoa.
You talked about first and second unit. Kelly, talk a little bit about what it takes to manage some of these scenes when you're dealing with first and second unit. I'm assuming they're coming in at different times. Do you try to edit first unit and stuff knowing you're waiting for second unit?
We usually just take the material as it comes in. And since they're shooting all over the world, that there are different time zones. So we're just getting everything in as soon as possible. We'll manage it differently based on time. And like on the other ones, we'd say, okay, you're going to take this action scene. You're going to take this action scene. So we divide it broadly like that. And then dialogue scenes, we just, it's whoever's free and things like that. But the just because it's easier to manage things if you're more familiar with the footage, right, for the big scenes. So on this one, a lot of times, say the Rio race, the second unit started to come in. So then I could concentrate on that type of thing. And then Dylan was on location in London. And when they were shooting green screen with the principal actors, he could be on set and do a really quick but really good pass on where those things, like I could give him the framework of the cars and then just put a title card and say, close up Momoa, whatever it is. And so just to block things out, and then he could be on set and get the video tap, cut those things in, see how they're working, and then build it that way. And then sometimes he'd be like, okay, Louis's happy with that. Or he could say, I didn't get a chance to get through these really closely, could you look through all the takes and see, do you think there's a better one for this? So we're like going back and forth on things like that. Mm-hmm. And we've worked together a lot. So we just have this kind of a shorthand on going back and forth. So we're doing both, but doing both first and second unit. The bridge was a lot of second unit. So just building that up together, just based on how the footage was coming in and based on timing, right?
And for the most part on these films, second unit leads first unit in terms of shooting order and schedule, like especially with the car chases and the blue screens, because you want to make sure that you need the blue screens that we shot in, at least in London. So the blue screens they shoot with the main unit characters, the lighting of those needs to match with what was shot in second unit in, be it Rome or be it Turin or Portugal, so that, because they'll shoot array plates for all the driving sequences that they got on the day. Sometimes it's sunny, sometimes it's bright, sometimes it's dappled lighting, sometimes it's all over the place. And if you do the blue screens first, then you're locked into a lighting and it's never really going to match. Then when you go to shoot the array plates, it's a completely different lighting. So just that nature of it kind of dictates what the shooting order has to be. So usually we'll cut the second unit. And sometimes you've got like a month between when the second unit shoots and when the first unit shoots. And sometimes you've got days or a week. So we kind of like to say we're a 24-hour cutting room, because I know I'm in London on location with my first assistant, Dylan Thomas, and Kelly, Laura, and Corbin were all back in Los Angeles cutting. So like, when my day ends, we're always in communication with each other. And I'm like, okay, Kelly, so here's what I did today. This is what I got to, blah, 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 blah. Whatever. I finish my day. Dailies come in LA. They pick up where they left off. Then she's either calling or writing me an email with, we love locators on sequences because we're always sending sequences back and forth. So it's just 80 locators of, this is what I got to hear. This isn't quite right, but it's the idea, or it's however we can maintain that constant communication back. Because it's not just communication for all of us in editorial, it's communication on the set. We might be shooting a scene that Kelly cut second unit for the day before on main unit, and then we're on set looking at her edit as the guide for how we're going to shoot the sequence, how we're going to cover the sequence, how they're going to light the sequence, and what they're going to match the lighting to. And so her notes to me are crucial because I'm communicating to Louis, this is the intention, and it's the more communication, the better.
Kelly, when you're cutting those scenes together, are you leaving plates? Are you leaving slates? Are you mocking something together? So what are you doing before the first unit is shot?
I usually put a title card in just to say, because you'll have the two stunty things, or you're going to be cutting to something in between.
Dante looks over his shoulder or something.
Yeah, then they'll do it in a really interesting way, because mine is just a very basic close-up Dante or shift gear or something like that. I don't put a fake shot in. I just usually just put what we want to have put in there. And then we'll put in the gear shifts and stuff, the pedals and stuff. We add that later. We don't usually put in those specifics.
There's second unit at the beginning and second unit after first unit.
Then what do we call that? The splinter unit.
We probably had 5 or 6 units shooting at one time, at one given time on this. And that's pretty common for these.
You've done some of the gear shift directing, Dylan, when you've been over there. And
yeah, I have. Yeah, because, I mean, you'll have second unit, splinter units.
Second unit.
You know, fight units for the fight sequences that will be going on at the same time as two separate second units. And they might also be shooting a insert unit. And there's like sometimes separate units that are shooting the car inserts versus shooting like the actual inserts. And there might be a C-cam that breaks away from main unit to shoot something else on another stage. In terms of like when these start getting up into speed, in terms of the sheer amount of dailies coming in from different units, there's visual effects units too that are going on. So there's so much coming in, which is why it's so critical for us to have like the awesome team that we have of everybody cutting, to always be up to camera as much as possible, all the assistants managing, organizing, prepping this for us.
How do you even manage knowing that something new came in for some scene that you might have edited 3 weeks ago?
Really, the assistants, they're amazing and awesome, and they organize, and we have those little post-its I think I talked about one time for the bands that they knew shot.
We've got a pretty good system of that, like all those kind of things, and checks and balances and double checks for every day. They'll build chem rules by unit, so you can just go through and see. Okay, there's 6 units. I like to watch them in shoot order personally, just so if the director's, oh, hey, I shot that early in the day, I know what he's talking about. I know what his day was like, because that's always going to be a preference for him. But so if we have 5 units going, I'll have 5 different sequences, so I know what each unit shot. I can scrub through that. The assistants go through, they mark everything up. They build all the bins. We've got like a whole folder structure set up where it's like you move things into cut, there's like new, they'll bring things back up into new, and then they flag them, like Kelly was saying, with post-it notes, so you can see within this giant bin of stuff that they might have been shooting on this scene for a week, there's just like a clear thing of this setup is new, this setup is new, this setup is new.
Or even a take that we didn't have that got missed, it'll flag that little one shot is new that we didn't have before.
For those who haven't listened to the previous interview, can you explain this post-it note that you're describing and how that works in the bin? Kelly?
I learned this from working with Tom Cross, because he did it, these digital post-its, and he learned it from me from somebody else. But they're like, if you have your bin, like we have a group clip at the top of the shot and then broken down by camera. Each clip has a broken down by camera underneath it, and then to the right of that, and then we do it by scene orders, not shot order, but scene order of the beginning, the middle, and end. And so these things are really big, so sometimes the bins will be separated by part one and part two and part three, and then to the right of the clip will be this digital post-it that'll say the clip name, and then it'll have the cameras. That's where they'll put additional notes in a different color, probably, that'll say new shot or missing shot. Then you can just get rid of it as you're working in the bin and you're done. Then you just get rid of that post-it, so the next time if they go in again and put something else in, then that shows up. But so whoever's cutting that scene, and we'll have our own, since you're in London and we're in LA, we have our own bins for a while until we merge, so we can work with it separately.
It's just great to just see like in thumbnail view like so right funny. Next to the thumbnails, easy. Like a big bright thing that says new with an arrow. So you're like, oh, this setup is new.
Yeah.
Or even like when you have a group clips that are stacked, if randomly B cam's missing, it's just nice to see like B cam was NG on this tape. It's just great visual things. So you're not like, oh, was there not a B on 12?
So you don't spend time looking for it or asking about it.
Especially since we kind of do the 24-hour cutting room. So my bins might be prepped by Los Angeles or vice versa. So the people who prep the bins might be asleep by the time like I'm actually working on them. So it's just great if like I come in at the beginning of my day and they've worked on prepping this scene bin all like their night to just, there's just no questions. Like everything is just easy spelled out. It's, oh, that's missing. That's at 48. That's new. It's just like a quick dummy proof kind of system. Mm-hmm.
Jason Momoa's character is really interesting, played super big and fun. Is that a thing that you needed to play with temperature? Did he give you options that you then had to regulate throughout the show?
He's talked about it in interviews a lot as well, is that he's at an 11 in this movie all the way through. And he gave us like a 20 down to like a 5. And so like, it was always a calibration. I think we wanted to end up at that sweet spot of an 11. He gave us definitely a big range, and it's finding where's too much, where's not enough, because he needs to be big. If he doesn't work, the movie doesn't work.
We really were like struggling with that, really played with that between the different previews. I think first we put everything in, and then that was too much. So then we took everything out based on notes and stuff. And then it was too dull and flat. And then you put some back in and trying to really, like Dylan said, just make it so he's interesting and fun, but you don't want to make it so you're making fun of the movie too much or too little, or his character. We're not trying to mock him. We need to take him seriously and yet have him have a good personality.
There is a ton of camera movement, obviously following chases, that kind of camera movement, but even in a scene that's more still, this director seems to like camera movement. What kind of challenges does that have for you? Even like setting up a bin, what thumbnail do I use when the shot goes from here to over there?
Sometimes we've actually done it, we'll thumbnail it through the sequence so you can see the movement of that setup across the takes and trying to get that instant idea of, oh, okay, that's the shot that does all of that motion. Louis definitely likes to move the camera. I think it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of kinetic energy that it adds. But it's also a challenge because Corbin could definitely speak to this more than the two of us. There's a scene early on where the camera's rotating around Bree and Alan Richson in the agency headquarters, and the camera, it starts moving, it doesn't stop. And it's with moving cameras, it's always a challenge when to get to a less moving camera or when to get to a static or when to stop it. And you sometimes have to add movement to stationary cameras to ease that in. It's always like, when works the best for the scene to start the move? When works the best for the scene to stop the move?
Kelly, did you cut the hand-to-hand combat stuff? And can you talk to the idea of how those scenes are cut and kind of the rhythm of the frenetic stuff compared to like moments where you've got to go, the two people are trying to recover or something? How is a fight scene cut?
On this one, Dylan cut the fight scenes, and my favorite one being the ladies' fight. He did a great job. I think that's a good one to talk about, the recovery and the, because there was two levels of it. And
yeah, talk about that. That's in Antarctica. Is that the one you're talking about?
I love that fight too. There's two levels where you fight at the upper level, they fight at the bottom level, and each level has its own kind of shape to the fight. Mm. And it has an arc where you need to start it slow, or because they literally crash through a pane glass window, then they have to recover. And so all that kinetic energy you built up, building up to the vault through that window, which in other fights could have been the end of the fight sequence, but then this one keeps going on this on the second level. You need to build to kind of what would be a climax of an action sequence, and then start slower, get faster with your cutting and rhythms and pacing, and then build up to then an even bigger ending at the actual ending of the sequence. The stunt people are great on this. They give you a lot, and both Michelle and Charlize also gave everything to that. There was a lot of stuff that we could cover on both of them doing their own stunts and hits, and weren't as limited by how long you can be on the shot of like a stunt actor or something. Mm-hmm. I think you're more limited by like the gags of like going through the window or going from level to level.
One of the great things about editing is that movie time is not the same as real life time, and it shouldn't be. It should, you want to extend moments, some moments, and other moments you want to condense. I wanted to play this scene for you because, and I did not think about this when I watched it in the movie theater, but then I watched this cut. This is the cannon car. When they first start using the cannons, the cars are about 100 yards from each other going full speed. They should connect within 2 seconds. This is 26 seconds. So I want to play this for you and talk to me about the challenge of cutting a scene where you have to extend 2 seconds to almost 30.
I think the thing with scenes like this, as you've seen with other movies, you know, on our really long runways, and Dylan and I have this thing too with countdowns that in our head we're counting down, and some people think about it and some people don't. You just hope that people just suspend that time and think more about the characters. And I think for most of these movies, if you just cut the stunts back to back, it's not as engaging as if you're in with the characters and listening to them and what they're saying and their banter and getting the emotion of it. And then I think you can just go, this was happening simultaneously, and you don't think about it until later. I think people are willing to suspend a little bit of reality if people are talking or saying something emotional or it's funny.
There's three scenes that I wanted to talk about. One is the car launching out of the airplane and landing on the highway, the car getting harpooned by the two helicopters, and the car going off the dam. It must be very challenging to make those seem realistic because people have to know that they can't possibly work in real life like that, but they felt like they did when you're watching the movie. So what are the tricks in editing that you have to do to make it feel real?
It's tricky, and we do talk about it and we laugh about it a lot, but it feels like you get into the moment, it does seem like an emotional thing. In every movie I can think of, the ones that were like, I don't know, is that gonna work? And it does. It's almost like a cartoon in a way, like Wile E. Coyote walking off the cliff for a few feet before he drops and you just buy it.
Yeah.
I think like one of the kind of tricks to this is taking the absurd seriously in these movies. Yes, to some extent, like we're definitely in on the joke and we'll comment on it, but like in the moment, you do need to take it seriously. Like the characters need to take it seriously. You need to take this crazy, absurd thing and play it straight. Dom needs to be 100% sold that this is the crazy thing that he needs to do to save his son, and you need to be invested with him. And if you're with him, you're with the gag.
Kelly, maybe you could speak to this, especially like I was thinking about the jumping off the dam sequence. I've been on those dams. There's 15 feet of runway, right, for that car to get up to speed, and then you've got a solid wall in front of you. How do you look at the footage you've got, the angles you've got, and construct a scene where the audience just goes, oh yeah, he backed up and he jumped the car off the dam and landed the car on the dam and it all works for me? Because it does, but there's just no way.
It's very earnest that this is happening. This is the character. His car can do it because it goes through, it defies bullets, it defies so many things. It fell out of a plane and yet it's still going. He can do these crazy stunts of 360s and saving his son. Everything adds up to it, the visual effects, the sound, they make the motor sound big, everything builds to it. His expression, the emotion, he's got to get his son out. Everything you do you think, okay, that's going to happen. That'll work because he did it and I'm seeing it. And just the car struggling on the dam. It's not easy. It's bumpy and it's having issue. You know, he has to shift gears and keep the tires on there, whatever the stunt is, hopefully adding those moments of realism and earnestness helps to sell the moment.
Yeah. When they first go to Rio, there's a montage kind of introducing Rio, and I love the rhythm of it. Can you talk to me about that Rio montage?
So I'm going to give a shout out to our first assistant, Dylan Thomas, who cut that sequence. He did an awesome job. We had him doing a lot during production. Louis really likes to make sizzle reels or kind of trailers to show the crew and the studio and the cast and get everybody just really jazzed and amped up. And I think all of those fell to Dylan, who we call D2.
Okay. You're
D1.
D1. Yeah. That was part of my interview process with him is, are you okay changing your name? But so he had done like a lot of the kind of like trailerly, like really heavy cut to music, which is, it's like its own, like cutting trailers is a completely different animal and beast. When seeing his work on those, we're like, okay, take a run at the Rio scene. I think we were shooting that sequence like main unit and like really needed something cut together, so to show the crew to get a flavor for where it was going to go from there. So it was like, just take it and run with it. He found that song from stuff that Universal Music had provided us and just kind of tracked that whole thing out. It definitely evolved throughout, and then we got more units to go back and get more kind of footage, and we, you know, a unit went to Rio to actually shoot some like big aerials and stuff. But that, I mean, it all started around the song and the rhythm of that, and you just build the flavor from there.
I want to ask two more questions, and one of them is, right after the montage, they're about to have a race, and I love the tension building up to the race. It felt kind of Western gunslinger to me as Dom and Dante prepare to race. Any thoughts on that sequence of how, you know, the audience is waiting for it? And you could just cut to it. They say they're going to race and then we cut to the race. But no, there's a sequence of anticipation, which I loved.
The one right before the starting line?
Or? Between the guns coming out and the starting line, there's some tension and anticipation in there.
I feel like the dailies really lent themselves to that. It was definitely a lot of building and evolution of that sequence over building that tension up of the guns drawing and how much to do and back and forth.
The big things that we did on Dante's character in specific was we did a lot of work in that scene and throughout the movie of just streamlining and targeting what his motivations were, what his relationship to his father was. That scene is the first scene where Dom and he come face to face. So it has to do a lot of heavy lifting for their relationship together. And if what each of them want out of that scene isn't clear, those two characters going head to head in the movie isn't going to work. So that scene was absolutely crucial to have. What is Dom's point of view? What is Dante's point of view? What's he there for? What are they there together to do and achieve? And that comes across in their standoff. I think that starting bit is some excellent tension building. Momoa does this great thing with his character where he starts in kind of one tone and he's being fun and he's going, oh, black on black look good. And as he pulls up to Dom and he's just playing with him and taunting with him. And then he goes on a dime into serious and just changes tone completely. And is at first he's just talking to Dom about like how much of a fan he is. And, oh, how do you do it? How do you save people? And then he just turns and he's like, how do you choose the ones you save? And that instantly cues this kind of almost music suspense led moment where Dom is realizing there's something else at play in this race, which starts to build to he's going to clock that Dante has put him up to make a choice between saving two people, which also was something that in the initial version of that race scene wasn't crystal clear. It was a bit muddier what the stakes of the race were about. At what moment does Dom realize that the bombs are under the car and he's going to have to make that choice? Laura came up with the idea of how to really restructure that race to give Dom that information a lot sooner, so it tied a lot more into the thematics of how do you choose the ones you save, what kind of Dante's philosophy is versus Dom's, and gave the race a lot more kind of tension and urgency.
Kelly, do you want to talk about how that evolved?
It's one of my favorite things about editing, how you can take something that was going one direction, restructure it based on, like Dylan said, Laura had this great idea because the race had to make it just more serious, make the stakes higher, to be able to restructure things in a way with the existing footage to create a different sort of moment and take the reactions, take the footage that you have and make it about these two bombs that are both going to go off and him choosing between the two and making it more about that. I think that's the magic of editing for everybody. I'm sure so many people have to do it on their shows. It's been such a long process. You almost forget what it used to be. It's just so fun to be able to take these moments and do something different. And this happens a lot. Second unit shoots first, and for whatever reason, maybe they can't get the first unit to be exactly what they wanted, or they change their minds. And then you're having to do things a lot of times with this footage that wasn't exactly what it was meant to be, but to make something out of it that's different. Or sometimes I'm just like happy that it went through and nobody said, what the heck? So sometimes it may not be the best thing, but at least, you know, it went through, it made sense, and you're going with it.
Final question. Near the end of the movie, there's a great jump cut section where weapons are being assembled. I think it's in Jason Statham's safe house. Just talk to me about the value of jump cuts and how to use them and make them look good.
With jump cuts, like the trick is always movement. You need to get a good dynamic movement to make those work. And then the second trick is repetition. It's not a innately correct edit. It always feels jarring at first. And it's kind of like jazz. If you play a bad note,
yep,
play it again. You need to have enough movement and enough repetition so that you can make it work as a style as opposed to a mistake.
Yeah.
And good sound too. Peter Brown and Paul, they did great with all the sound effects work to make it very satisfying and heavy.
You needed to track them a lot of times. Certain things that won't work without track, like just visually, like speed ramps, especially like if you're doing some sort of stylized ramping through a scene, sometimes like you need to hit a music edit on that or hit a beat on that or hit like a whoosh or a sound, or like with jump cuts, like with the packing the bag, like you need those big sharp sounds to accentuate the staccato nature of the edit so that the sound works with the picture and they're not fighting.
Before we wrap things up, do you guys want to give a little shout out to some of the people on your team?
We had awesome crew on this. First assistants I had on location with me, Dylan Thomas back in LA. We had Mike Acevedo, Dove Samuel. We had a second assistant, Megan Ellsworth, and awesome visual effects editorial team, Kim Houston, Steve No, Ben Howdesell, Sharon Smith-Holly, JP Husky, Delaney Delvecchio, Paul Hart.
Lee for a short while.
Anybody else on your team, Kelly?
They were all part of the same team. And then we had Paul Rapp. Johns was our music editor, his fantastic music editor, who, you know, not only does things with temp, but writes things and makes his own bridges and songs himself.
And there's a lot of music in this movie.
Lots. And then, as we said, Peter Brown, Paula Lucino. And then we had mixers, John Taylor, Frankie Montagna. We had our great PAs, Elena Kutras, who helped us from the beginning, and then Liana Montagna, who helped us once we got on the mixing stage.
In London, I also had Lucy Hayworth, Hugo Cantrell, and Alia Nazarali as our local crew. all awesome.
Kelly and Dylan, thank you so much for joining me on Art of the Cut today. That's it for Art of the Cut this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, if you'd prefer to read this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to borisfx.com/AOTC, where there's a ton of great expert content for filmmakers of all types. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors, for a topic-driven curated look at the craft of editing. Thanks to Kelly Matsumoto, ACE, and Dylan Highsmith for joining me on Art of the Cut. Thanks to Nathan Blakely for editing today's podcast. And thanks to our partner, BorisFX, and to our sponsors, Jump Desktop and Lens Distortions. Be sure to check them out at borisfx.com, jumpdesktop.com/cut, and lensdistortions.com/AOTC. I'm Steve Hallfish. Thanks for listening. And please tell all the editors and filmmakers that you know that to get more great Art of the Cut content every week, please subscribe on your favorite podcast app. And for a great feed of editing wisdom from Art of the Cut, follow me on Twitter at Steve Hallfish or on Insta at AOTC Podcast.